certainly in the media space and in the social space, the opportunity for women in particular, but men too, to have body dysmorphia and actually sort of have an entity that kind of looks like them, but isn't really them because it's all smooth with, you know, there's so many applications now that can smooth you out and back glow you and make you look like some celestial being, which, you know, it's not actually what you look like anymore. So yeah, I just say own it and you'll feel a lot better in the long run.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to inspirational leaders from all over the world to dispense wisdom for life, business, and career. In order to provide you shortcuts to excellence, my name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of the Professional Development Forum and your host for today. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age to find fulfillment in the modern workplace. Our guest today is Mary Labrie. Mary Labrie is a writer and producer of radio, podcast, and film. Mary is a founder and director of Women of a Certain Age, a digital media company that aims to inform, inspire, and entertain women traveling beyond 50. Mary is a director and principal of a strategy consulting firm, Clear Advantage. She has consulted to blue chip enterprise and government clients on strategy, marketing, and digital transformation. She has taught management, leadership, and marketing at the University of British Columbia in Canada, the University of New South Wales in Australia, and the University of California, Santa Barbara in the United States. In her spare time, she is a volunteer rescuer and carer for Australian wildlife. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Well, it's such an honor to have you with us today, and I'd love to just jump right into it.
Let's do it.
What is the first lesson?
The first lesson is we all respond to incentives. So my career, I suppose, started when I was somewhere between the ages of 6 and 7, when I had my first little business, which was a golf ball selling enterprise. And I had a business partner, his name was Richard, and we had a pretty amazing team in terms of I grew up right next to a golf course. And so in the evening, when there was no one golfing, Richard and I would go up there, and he was extremely good at finding golf balls. So the first time he did it, I was quite astonished and thought it was quite an amazing thing, because it was a perfect golf ball. It had no flaws. It was, you know, obviously some golfer had just sliced it right into the forest and it only had one shot before it disappeared. And so these were just the kinds of balls we wanted to have in our shop. And so I decided that to get Richard to do that more often, I would reward him. And the thing that really worked for Richard was little pieces of cheese. So every time he found a golf ball, I gave him a piece of cheese. Now, it probably, spoiler here, Richard was a Cocker Spaniel. He was our dog. But we became like an amazing team, and that little business really helped me get my pocket money and create a better and better enterprise, so that I became quite a successful little businesswoman. But it did make me think about the importance of rewarding and how that actually creates, not only does it, you know, create a behavior that you're looking for in your business, but it also makes your partner, the person you're working with, feel great because they're getting something out of it. And I think that was probably the first time I started to think about how people were motivated. I mean, I didn't have that kind of language at the age of 6 or 7, but I did actually understand that for Richard, it was cheese. And it's important to understand what other people, you know, when we're talking about humans that we work with, what their cheese is and what your cheese is. Because I found for myself that I was not as motivated by money or bonuses or financial recognition. What I really liked was just being thanked for it. Occasionally you do something above and beyond, you know, having someone thank you for it and say, you know, that was a really good job you did. That, strangely enough, is my cheese. So doesn't happen very often though. So that, I think, is something I tried to do when I was working and had people working for me in my team, is to let them know that I recognize them for what they did. So yeah, I remember at one point when I was working at Telstra, I got this very significant award. It was called the Best Award. And it's the highest award you can get if you're not a salesperson. And I was working in digital transformation and we brought in this big online portal. We delivered it. And I was recognized. I was given the Best Award for that year. I think it was 2010. But nobody had actually told me that this award was happening. So I wasn't even there. And there were lots of financial benefits to getting that award. But the thing I really wanted was for somebody to actually thank me for doing all that work, along with all the team members. And none of us were there to receive that award. So it was a bit of a tragedy, but it did make me think once again about reward and recognition and how important it is to understand what a person's cheese is, because that's the key to having a high-performing, happy team, I think.
Excellent. Lesson number two, be strategic with your suppliers. Tell me more about this.
Right. Yeah. So moving along in my career, I became, the head ice cream scooper at an ice cream parlor when I was in high school. And it was a cutthroat, very competitive trade where we were, which was down near the beach in Vancouver. And there were a whole bunch of different ice cream vendors all competing. And I noticed that my manager was stressing out a little bit about that competition. And I noticed also that everyone had the same flavors. Now, this is long before the gazillion flavors of ice cream and gelato and yogurt that are available today. Back then, there were literally about seven flavors. And I happened to know a family that made their own ice creams. And they were beautiful sort of gourmet ice creams and, somewhat obscure. They were Italian, so they served the Italian community in Vancouver. And I spoke to my manager and I said, maybe we could get a few other ice cream flavors in, and that might actually attract a few people. And we could give little samples and get people all excited about these different flavors, which we tried. And it worked because, if there's anything that motivates people, it's good ice cream. So it got me thinking about how important it is, who your suppliers are, and how important procurement is. Now, flash forward to, 2000, when I was working as a consultant, mostly in the telecommunications industry, and mostly during that transformation of broadband, so everything was about broadband. And there were networks being built by Telstra, there was a network being built by Optus, and was it going to be HFC, was it going to be ADSL, was it going to be VDSL? There was all this, buzz around that, and a whole bunch of vendors trying to sell their gear into these very large clients, which on global scale were actually quite small clients. But the thing I really reflected on there was how important it was with procurement to make sure that you chose a partner for procurement, for supply, that was stable, had good volumes, and had, basically not a bleeding edge solution, but something that actually worked. And there were some very expensive mistakes made in that decade because the technology and engineering side wanted something that was as leading edge as possible, as fast as possible, feature rich. But sometimes that was quite dangerous because you were actually working with unstable technologies and with solutions that literally just didn't have volume yet on a global scale. So that whole thing about procurement is an absolute must. You must have a focus around that in order to have competitive advantage, I think.
Yep, absolutely. I agree with that. And I'll notice you used the word partner instead of suppliers there. It suggests in terms of your working relationship, the mindset that you've got to have in order to work with them. Clearly, you've got a very entrepreneurial spirit, starting your business at 6 years old. And as a young worker, to even see through that competition, that is something that I respect a lot. So lesson number three, I like this one. You are the brand.
Yes. You can talk about this in so many different ways, Jeffrey. And I think the one that I will talk about is I now have a company called Women of a Certain Age. It's a media company. And I speak to women who are over 50 about what it means to be a woman over 50. And there's a lot packed into that, let me tell you. I was getting some material made for that. We're doing a podcast. We have a couple of different podcasts, as you do. You've got a podcast. I've got a podcast called Women of a Certain Age. And I also have a special show called The Midlife Crisis Hotline, which is a comedy show. And we were getting some graphics made up for that. And there's a photograph of me. So I had some headshots taken. I don't like getting photographs taken at the best of times, but, you know, I did it because I was told to do it. And I did what I was told. So I went and got some photos taken. And I was looking at these photos with the graphic artist. Now, this is the brand of our show, and it's the brand of my enterprise. I mean, I am the brand, literally. So here I am looking at these photographs. And, you know, I'm a woman of a certain age also. So I'm looking at them. And I'm going, I said to the graphic artist, look, could you maybe take out those very deep vertical wrinkles I have right in between my eyebrows? I mean, they are literally as big as the Grand Canyon, those two wrinkles, and maybe a couple on the side too. My graphic artist, and I have to thank him for this, he said, Mary, isn't one of your values authenticity? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're wrinkly. And you know what? You can't be angry about that. It's actually a beautiful truth. And in fact, if you are speaking authentically to women over 50, you know, you don't want to be airbrushing your face and pretending you look like some other person. So it was a beautiful lesson and I love it. So you are the brand, quite literally. Be authentic, represent it.
But it takes a lot of confidence too, mind you. I mean, and I suppose this is something that takes a bit of gray hairs to be able to understand, you know, in terms of embracing who you really are, that authenticity. I don't believe people are born with that natural confidence to accept yourself, flaws and all. I can certainly identify with the insecurity a lot of us have also putting ourselves out there as we are. How do you overcome that fear of judgment when you're just not so sure?
I don't think there's a pat answer to that. But you do have to accept yourself and stand by yourself, literally. Because if you won't, who will? You can't take yourself too seriously. I mean, this is part of life. Part of life is getting wrinkles. And I'm proud to say that I smile as openly and unguardedly as I can. And with that comes wrinkles. And I wouldn't regret a single moment of that. But it is, you do have to just kind of shake yourself and go, you know, be real. Certainly in the media space and in the social space, the opportunity for women in particular, but men too, to have body dysmorphia and actually sort of have an entity that kind of looks like them, but isn't really them because it's all smooth with, you know, there's so many applications now that can smooth you out and back glow you and make you look like some celestial being, which, you know, it's not actually what you look like anymore. So yeah, I just say own it and you'll feel a lot better in the long run. I realized with my little golf ball enterprise that I was the brand also. I mean, initially I didn't understand it because I am a kid, you know, but what I realized was that I was actually the brand of that enterprise. And a lot of the reason why, you know, gentlemen, it was mostly gentlemen, would stop at my little shop because I had my golf balls displayed in an egg carton, you know, and it was all very nicely decorated. And Richard was there, of course. They were stopping because, you know, I was this cute little kid sitting on the side of the road with, you know, I was a little bit of a, you know, a scruffy tomboy, but, you know, they were stopping because I was there and I'd have a really nice smile on and I'd go, good morning, would you like to look at my golf balls here? I've got some great golf balls. And, you know, they'd come over and I kind of figured it out that I was a lot of the reason why they were coming over. Did they actually need some more golf balls? Probably not. But, you know, it's almost like a kid with a lemonade stand. There's an aspect of that, that you're appealing and that's why they're there. That's why they come to your shop. So I understood it even at that stage.
So at the age of 6, you've got that level of self-awareness that is pretty impressive.
I'll wear a clean t-shirt. It might drive up sales.
That's funny. Lesson number 4 is cryptic to me. Channel like a babysitter, but it sounds like there's a bit of a story behind that.
Well, yeah. So once again, I love to reflect on the businesses that came before the MBA and all that stuff, you know, because those are very formative. But I'm the third child. And so my sister and my brother both had babysitting jobs. You can probably tell we all, you know, we all needed pocket change and we weren't getting it from our parents. So we had all these little side hustles going. my sister was a babysitter, and then she passed all of her clients on to my brother. I went and I picked up his clients. So he hated babysitting. So it was great. I was able to pick up his clients, and there was almost like a legacy of these clients coming through the LaBrie family. And that was a great way of gathering a very significant client base from the discards of someone who no longer wanted to serve those clients. I figured out, well, if it works in the family, it probably works in the neighborhood. So I ended up going around to other kids that were babysitting and complaining about it and going, well, you know, if you're not enjoying that, you know, I can pick that up for you because I'm free on Saturday. So I ended up sort of picking off clients from all the kids in the neighborhood that really weren't all that into babysitting and didn't really need to do it. I realized that was a great way of picking up clients is pick up the work from people who either don't want to do those clients or don't have time to do those clients. And I realized that that was actually something I could carry into later on. When I had my first consulting business, I did an MBA, and then I was working for one of the very large consulting firms, Arthur Andersen. And Arthur Andersen was a mainframe consulting IT company. You know? So they did major mainframe installations, and a lot of the systems were written in COBOL, which I actually know sort of writing, but I used to anyway. I hated programming. But anyway, that's another story. Well, what I detected, this was the beginning of the microcomputer revolution, which we now, you know, we all have laptops, but that started out as what was called a microcomputer. Now, Arthur Andersen didn't want to deal with microcomputers, really. That wasn't their bread and butter. And they saw it as kind of like an annoying thing that, you know, they had to talk to clients about because clients were asking about it. Well, that's where I got my first clients from, is the cast-offs of Arthur Andersen's microcomputer clients. They didn't want to teach them how to do Lotus 1-2-3, which was one of the first spreadsheet programs. Bill Gates, thank you very much. And, you know, all of the other things that had to be learned, you know, the word processing software and the operating system and so on. That was my first client base. I had a little company called Micro Directions. And it was the cast-offs of Arthur Andersen. So I set up my own company and off I went. And as you know, microcomputers became a bit of a thing.
Oh, yes. So that's brilliant. So learning how to operate the channel means that you can reduce your client acquisition costs and you can build a business around that. So that's awesome. Now, I don't know if I should be proud to say, but I know what Lotus 1-2-3 is. That kind of shows my age, but I am glad that I can honestly put hand on heart and say that I can't program in COBOL.
Well, I learned it. You know, everyone who worked at Arthur Andersen had to learn COBOL, and I'm not a programmer. I'll just say that right up front. I definitely tried to avoid any engagements that involved programming, but it was a great organization. I learned a lot there.
Wow. There you go. So lesson number 5, don't panic, just think.
Yes. Before I did an MBA, I did a forest biology degree and I became a forest biologist. I worked in the beautiful forests of British Columbia, which are wild and dense and quite an interesting environment, very easy to get lost. I was a trained compass person. They were always called compassmen, but I was obviously not a man. And so compass person, compass woman, which means you're the person who literally finds the direction through the bush and takes the crew through. We used to get dropped off in one place with a float plane, and I'd have to get us over to some other place with pretty much precision and get picked up by a float plane on the other side of an island or on the other side of some bush or on a lake or whatever.
Was that GPS back then?
No. It was all analog. Because of some problems with the maps that were provided to us, and because we split the crew on that day, I ended up actually getting lost in a very densely forested area that was closed for logging. So there was no truck traffic through there. And it's hard to describe a British Columbian forest, but they are dense. And you can literally not hear somebody who is yelling when they're about 10 meters away. That's how dense the forest is. It just absorbs sound. It's incredible. So anyway, I was on my own. I had an incorrect map, but I had my compass. And I realized I was lost. And I don't know if you've ever had that feeling before, Jeffrey, but it is a pretty terrible feeling. It is scary, beyond scary, in a lot of ways. So my adrenaline was pumping, my heart was hammering in my chest. I was freaking out, thinking, how am I going to find my crew in this forest? And the temptation is to actually do crazy stuff like run, or I don't know, you know, I wanted to run. I actually wanted to run, even though that wasn't a good idea. But all I did was I sat down and I absolutely had to chill out, you know, and I had to force myself to chill out, which took quite a while because there was so much adrenaline pumping in my system. I was afraid. And then I let my brain, you know how to do this. You are a compass person. You've got a compass. You kind of know where you are. You know how to get out of here. But, you know, you have to actually calm down and stop. Now, it may not sound like this is relevant to somebody who's working in business or in corporate life, but it absolutely is, because we can be seized with fear. There's a whole bunch of reasons why that can happen. Some of them are because of you all of a sudden realize the risk you've taken on. You realize what's at stake. You realize your team's at stake for some reason, whatever it happens to be. And all I can say is that was such a powerful lesson for me, because I realized I could handle it. And if you realize you can handle it, you can, you know, and it's hard to explain. I don't want to sound too Zen, but it was a very powerful lesson for me.
Wow. And you managed to get out of the forest?
I did. I won't go into how there's a whole process for finding your way out of a forest like that. And I don't want to get all Bear Grylls about it, but I did. Within a couple of hours, I managed to get myself onto a logging road. And then once I was on the logging road,
you knew where you were.
Sorted. Yeah. Although there wasn't a lot of logging trucks, so there's still a process to get back, but yeah, it happened. I'm here.
Sorry to spoil the ending, but
didn't get eaten by a bear.
No. Well, in British Columbia, that could be, and it could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, on the bear topic there, the area I was in, there were a lot of bears, but they were black bears, and black bears are not aggressive really, unless you get in between them and their cub or their cubs, but grizzly bears are another matter. But I wasn't working in that sort of area.
That's a useful fact. Lesson number six, you need to ask. Now, I know this is difficult with some people.
Yes. So this is all about pay. And I know some people say, and I know I said initially that, you know, a recognition for me is not about money, but recognition for, you know, extra effort is a different thing than pay, which is what you get paid for what you do every day. And I think that it's enormously important, especially for women, to really bring their A game when they're trying to get their salary where they want it to be. And it's quite a strategic exercise to get your salary where you want it to be. And you must look at it that way. Don't just let it happen or not speak about it. That's also, I think, a bit of a mistake. And just let them figure out what you're going to get paid. And this is something where I think women don't negotiate it. And this is a generalization, but it's borne out by statistics with the pay gap, that the women don't tend to want to bring it up, and they don't know how to ask for it. And there's a very nice, calm way to ask for it, which is to know what you're worth, know what the market is, and ask for that. And I always add 20% on because it's easier to come down than to go up. It's very hard to go up. Once you put a number out there, very hard to go up. I think that I've been reasonably successful in the way I've been remunerated. And I do despair about the pay gap and the fact that I think many of my fellow women, you know, struggle with this. So I think that that's worth looking into and studying and coming at that from an organized point of view.
But it's easier said than done, right? It's one thing to say, go and ask for it, but how do you overcome that mindset, that voice in your head that sort of tells you that you can't?
Oh, I think you do have to be a little bit full of yourself. That probably helps. And I probably got a slice of someone else's ego in addition to my own. But I think you do have to, you know, be your most powerful, strongest advocate, believe in yourself. But yeah, if you're a good operator and you do a good job and you know what the market is, you already know what you're worth. So I think it's important to know what you're worth, to know where the market's at. This is not easy to get at, but it is possible to get at. It takes a bit of it, but it is well worth it. It is well worth understanding what you're worth because the 50-year results of negotiating a good salary are substantial, as we all know. So, yeah.
Absolutely. You have to know what you're worth.
Yeah. And there's no downside. There's no downside. A person looking at you, if you're going to someone and say, I think I'm worth this, and they think you're worth, I say 100, you say 80, are they going to look at you badly because you've asked for 100? Probably not. You know, there's no downside. You might as well go for it. That's the way I look at it.
That's such an interesting insight, because I believe a lot of people probably undervalue themselves, because they believe that if they were to overstate their value, that would go against them in that situation. And you're right, because when I put myself on the other side of that negotiating table, I realize that the starting price that the other person put up tends to be a bit of a peg in terms of where their value is. Even if I don't believe they're worth that value, I would not go out of my way to argue it. And that's such an interesting insight. Thank you for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Lesson number 7, to lead, you have to learn to follow. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, on the topic of ego, I think that particularly in the middle of my career, I suppose in my 30s and 40s, when I was, I think, hitting my stride, I probably thought I was pretty darn good. And occasionally, I think I would have been a bit of a challenge to manage. Some of my managers out there, if they listen to this podcast, you're like, ah. So, you know, it's fine to have a strong sense of self and to have ideas about how things should be managed. But there's a wonderful line in Game of Thrones. I think it's not Ser Jorah, but his dad. His name's Jorah Mormont, who's the head of the wall, you know? And he's talking with Jon Snow. And Jon Snow thinks he's pretty good too, right? Especially relative to the other guys, you know, because he's, you know, expert swordsman. He's trained in a castle. He's, you know, he's like a lord. Whereas there's all these guys around him who are farmers and pickpockets and whatnot, and they don't know how to use swords. So he thinks he's pretty hot. And Jorah Mormont says to him, if you want to lead, you're going to have to learn how to follow. And I think that is just like so correct. We do have to learn how to follow. We do need to respect our bosses, the people who manage us, who have a tough job. Usually they're looking after a team. They've got a lot of stuff to think about. You've got some great idea that you immediately want actioned because, you know, you're full of ego and you think you're the best thing since sliced bread. But yeah, so that was something I had to learn, is to temper my ego, temper my idealism and my ideas and cherishing my ideas above all others, and learn to follow a good manager, of which I've had many. I'm very thankful to say.
Excellent. So if I could paraphrase that, it sounds like you're a bit of a natural leader from a young age. However, to become a better leader, you have to learn to become a team player. And I agree with that. I agree with that. I know a lot of people aren't natural leaders, and it takes them a long time to understand that they can take that leadership position. They may not have the natural ego that's required for leadership, but I absolutely can take the point that someone with that natural confidence in themselves, in order to get to that next level of leadership, you need to learn how to be humble, to work with others and be part of a good team.
And take direction. Take direction. Absolutely.
Now, number 8, I have to say I'm absolutely in agreement with. Embrace those who think different to you. Why is that so important?
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, the first time I kind of came across this, there was all these wonderful tools that were coming out, you know, say 20 years ago, 30 in some cases, like the DISC profile and the Belbin analysis and so on. You know, we'd have team days and you'd do the DISC profile and you'd find that there were, you know, small number of D's, small number of I's, a whole bunch of S's and a whole bunch of C's. Now, I don't know whether the listeners will know what that means. I'm an I, I'm an influencer. I love ideas. I love influencing others and selling ideas to others. But I have a bit of D in me as well, which is the dominance aspect. It's, you know, people tend to be very results oriented and like to drive. The S part of DISC is, I think, what they call steadiness. But I also think of it as a person who's quite sensitive to the needs of others. So they tend to be aware of the team and how people are feeling about things and who's got concerns, et cetera. And then the C's are these wonderful analytical people who, you know, they quite often raise objections and I have concerns and outlying risks. And, you know, so when I was learning about all of that, somebody said to me, you know, oh, you're an I, so you would hate working with C's. And apparently that's supposed to be the case, that I's and C's don't get along very well. But I completely disagree with that. I love C's. I think they are the best. They are the best. Number one, I really admire their meticulousness and the fact that they get into the details. They know the numbers. If you don't have somebody that's calling out risks and concerns and testing and, you know, really testing the ideas, then you have a problem in your team. So I love C's. S's are very important too. There's a lot of S's, so we don't need to worry about that. There aren't as many C's and we should value and prize them and tell them how wonderful they are. Give them cheese. Whenever they want it. So that's one thing I would say. Does that make sense? What I've just...
Yeah, absolutely. It makes perfect sense to me. I mean, it's something of my belief as well, that I believe that it's about the complementarity of the people you work with. Sometimes people who enjoy the detail versus people who enjoy the big picture. But if we don't have both of these people, it's very difficult to execute.
Absolutely.
Though is that a lot of us tend to, you know, prefer the familiar, prefer people agree with us. It's almost counterintuitive to be accepting or even embracing people who are opposite to us. So how do you get yourself into that mindset where you can welcome people who think differently?
Yeah. I think the way to appreciate people with a different mindset is to acknowledge that you yourself do not have a complete thinking pattern, that you have preferences in terms of the way you think of things. There's wonderful partnerships between people with very different thinking styles and how they can really complement each other. If you've read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, you know, there's a beautiful two people in that with just like vastly different thinking. It's beautifully illustrated on this road trip that they go on. If you acknowledge that you yourself are somewhat incomplete and that you aren't perfect and there are going to be things you miss, because if you're like me, like if you're an I, then you need to make sure someone's testing that idea for its feasibility. If you're a D and you're just wanting everybody to charge ahead and get stuff done, well, you need those other quadrants, because charging ahead, you might be going in the wrong direction entirely. So this is why we need these other people. They really round out and balance out a team. Here's a perfect example. When you're in an ad agency or in a marketing team, you tend to get a lot of marketing people. They tend to be, a lot of them are eyes. They love stuff. You know, they love brand. They love ideas. But if that's all you've got on the floor, you've got a problem. You know, you've got a problem. You're probably going to be spending too much money in the wrong places and maybe coming out with a campaign that's actually just offensive to some of your customers. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing if you acknowledge it and embrace it, I think.
Yeah, and it certainly sounds like you have to have that awareness and humility to know that you don't have all the answers.
Yeah, totally. The other one I love, and this one doesn't get enough playtime in corporate life, particularly in the traditional meeting setting, and that is the beauty of an introvert. Now, introverts don't tend to speak as much during meetings. And I, for one, you know I can flap my gums like the best of them. So, wow, make sure you listen to your introverts, because they're thinking, they're listening, and their brain is working overtime. And they've got something to say if you just listen to it. So I think we should all acknowledge and appreciate the introverts in the room. They don't get enough airtime.
Yep, I'm 100% on board with that one. Lesson number 9. I like this one because it sounds like a bit of a call to action. There's always something you can do.
Yeah. So this is really about supporting your colleagues. And as a woman, I believe that that's been a really important thing that I have tried to do throughout my career. I've come across situations where women that I've been working with have been bullied. They have been made redundant while they're on maternity leave. They've been harassed. And of course, quite often are just sidelined or have some other inappropriate behavior occurring. And I think it's always been really important that even if all you do is stand with that person, that already makes such a difference to that person on a psychological level, because so often we have to stand alone when these things are happening. And this isn't just, you know, a woman's issue, but it certainly is an issue for women. So I think standing with a colleague, if you see bullying happening in your workplace, you must stand with your colleague. You must stand up. The bystander is as guilty as the bully, and you will feel that guilt. So I think that it's really important to stand with those people that are around us and stand on those principles, even if there's risk to you personally.
There's a good old saying, right? All that it takes for evil to prevail is for the good men to do nothing. My question, though, is that at what point would you be empowered to do so? You know, some people believe that it's not until they've made it to senior management before they have the power to do something about this. What if you're just someone who's starting out and aren't in the position to be able to take that sort of risk in standing up for what you believe?
Yeah, certainly when you've got a bit more clout, the effect is more powerful and more immediate. But, you know, look at someone like Christine Holgate. She's the CEO of Australia Post, or she was, and even she was treated in a certain way. There was no one standing with her. So yes, even a very powerful person can be left alone with a difficult set of circumstances. And I do believe that a lower level person, any person, can stand with another person. And when these things are happening, in fact, I think it's just as powerful. And it's, you know, it's personally important that you do so. If you don't, you're going to feel the guilt of that. I think it's a really powerful thing for anyone to do at any level. It is actually really helpful for the individual just to know that you're there, that you stood with them, you stood by them when that was happening.
I agree with that. There's always something you can do.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the final lesson. Develop a side hustle early.
Yes. So here I am, a woman of a certain age. I'm 66. And yeah. Oh my God. 66. Yeah. But when I was probably in my late 40s, early 50s, I started thinking, you know, I can see that the workplace is an ageist place. I was in a team. I won't identify the organization. It was a digital team. And by the time I left that team, I was the only person over 50 still working there. And I left to go and do something else. But all of the older people, all the people in there over 50 had been let go. So over a 2-year period, they had all just disappeared. And I was the last of the Mohicans. And I thought to myself, I am not going to let myself be vulnerable in this way. I'm not going to let myself be at the mercy of people who will judge me simply because I have some wrinkles and I'm over 50 and maybe I don't know what the, you know, the latest hip hop singer is. So, you know, because I've got a lot to offer. So that's when I started developing my side hustle, because I thought I'm going to have this ready because at some point I'm going to need it. And I think that that was a good foresight to have. And I encourage anyone who's in their middle career to be thinking about this, because if you are an employee, you will be vulnerable. If you have your own business, you're not as vulnerable because, you know, there's a whole bunch of people running their own business. You know, they're not asking anybody whether they can continue doing their business, whether it's financial planning or, you know, selling coffees at the corner. They are their own business person. And I had my own consulting business, all corporate clients. I knew there was going to come a time when the corporate clients would even be looking at me and judging me as to whether I was getting too old to be doing this kind of work, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to, in their 50s, if not sooner, to start to develop their own little side hustle so that they're not going to be vulnerable to this. You know, with COVID in particular, people over 50 have been hit very, very hard with being made redundant or not. So yeah, develop your own little side hustle. Maybe not golf balls necessarily, but something that you enjoy and that you have a passion for. And I think it'll keep you in good stead as you move through your career.
Wise words, and develop them early too, mind you. Yeah. So how early did you start? You're saying, is it 50s or is it 40s?
Yeah, I was 50 when I started developing it up. The other one is, and you've probably heard this expression, the side helpful. You got your side hustle and your side helpful. As you move through, you do have some bandwidth. You can do something for others, you know, and find your side helpful. Mine is being a wildlife rescuer and carer. Australian Wildlife. I love that. I do some other things as well, but that's probably my main side helpful. Yeah. think about that as well, because you'll get a lot of enjoyment out of that as well. It's very hard when we're all in the throes of our career and we've got to work big hours and, you know, all that stuff's going on. But at some point, I think it's really worthwhile to think about what your side helpful might be as well.
I like that, side helpful. So we love to throw our guests a bit of a curveball at the end of the 10 lessons.
Right.
And we usually ask, what have you unlearned? So what I mean by that is something that you believe to be ironclad truth when you started out your career, something that you just assume to be a time-tried truth, but then throughout your career, throughout your years, you've learned that it's just not the case. Is there anything that you can think of that you've unlearned as a lesson?
Starting out as a forest biologist, so I was in a forestry faculty. There were 7 women and 140 men, you know, very male dominated. Got into telecommunications, also a lot of males in there too. And I had clients in energy and government, a lot of blokes about. And I think when I started out, I thought I have to kind of be a bloke to succeed almost. I know I don't look like a bloke, but sometimes you can feel like a bloke on the inside and you think you have to model your behavior around the way men are because they succeed and they get things done and they rise. I think initially I was probably doing that a little bit, being a bit blokey and not acknowledging my female colleagues as well, because there weren't that many around. And then, you know, as time went on, more and more female colleagues came on the scene. And I guess I really, at some point, decided to unlearn that, because it's glorious to be a woman and it's challenging and it's interesting and it's divine. We bring something very special to everything we do. You know, that was something I had to unlearn is, you know, you don't have to be a bloke. And you don't want to be a bloke, because there's great adventure in being a woman, and there's great adventure being a woman in a corporate context, because it's more challenging.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much today, Mary. Thank you for your openness, your authenticity. I love your colorful stories. I love how animated and passionate you are. It is just such an enlightening experience for me to get into your 10 lessons.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I really didn't think I had anything to say, but
and yet here you are.
And here we are.
Love those stories. And we'll finish on that note.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for career, business, and life. Our guest today has been Mary LaBrie, sharing 10 lessons it took her 50 years to learn. This episode is produced by Robert Hossery, sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which offers insights, community discussions, podcasts, parties, anything you want, anything you need, and it's all free. You can find them online at www.professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that makes the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. Thank you for listening, and stay safe, everyone.